time.
If I get up at 15 minutes before 1 it's and walk out, it's not because I'm being
called. Yes, yes. So everybody else stay. Well, this is a real pleasure for me to welcome you all and to introduce the speaker, who is he's part of the World Views of Aspiring Powers project, and he is a visiting scholar from JNU, Jawaharlal Nehru University. But I'm especially happy to have him because Yogesh Joshi has used, and this is something that many, you know, as a professor, one of the best things that you can hear is that a PhD student is actually applying one of your frameworks to their dissertation. And so, based on a book that I published with my colleague, World Views of Aspiring Powers, which lays out a schools of thought approach to comparative foreign policy, I'm happy to say that Yogesh is taking that framework one step further and hopefully, you know, making it even better and refining it in a way that'll be very useful. So he's a PhD student at JNU. JNU is the top international relations university. It focuses almost entirely on international relations. And he has already done quite a bit of publishing, which is quite unusual, especially in for students in India who don't get a lot of opportunities, unlike some of the PhD students here. So he has made it a point to do that, and so I was very happy that under my project we could actually bring him here. He's here for just a month. I think you have another 10 days left or something,
yeah.
Something like that. So this is one of his charges, is to give a presentation on some work that he's looking at. And I'm sure this will be, you know, it's an informal kind of talk, but it'd be good to get questions and your thoughts at the end, because I know it'll be useful for his PhD that he has to finish when he goes back. So without further ado, Yogesh.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ulapadi.
And if there's any problems with, you know, if you don't like his talk or there's any issue, you can blame it on me, since the framework is from us.
You can complain to me as well. I would really like to hear that. Thank you, Dr. Ulapadi. Thank you, Professor McCord, and the Sigu Center to have hosted me. Basically, I'm guilty of those visiting scholars who really don't, whose presentation is not related to their PhD, just because, you know, as Professor McCord said in the last presentation, but I wanted to do something which had to relate to the contemporary debates going on and also the Rising Powers Initiative, so to say. So when I actually proposed this whole idea to Dr. Ulapalli, she kind of liked it. The whole idea basically was to see how India is responding to the strategic flux in Asia Pacific, especially with regard to US decline and China's rise, and see what kind of domestic policy debates are actually taking place within India, and especially whether one can use some of the work which is coming from Sigu Center to specifically locate these policy debates. To just look at it, you know, George Panetta actually came to India in spring of last year and said that India is going to be the linchpin of US rebalancing strategy, and AK Antony, whose photo is down below, who's the defense minister of India, is basically saying, no, not so fast, Mr. Secretary of Defense, let every nation move at its own comfortable pace. This kind of gives you the tussle which is actually taking place regarding Indian foreign policy, so to say. The main arguments which I have for you today is, first of all, that the domestic debate is between those who see rebalancing as a strategic concern and those who view it as a strategic opportunity. I'll explain on it what I mean by it. The second main argument is that India is stretched between non-alignment 2.0 and alignment 2.0. And I'll explain again what basically this means. And the last argument which I'm going to present today is that which way will India go? And my own idea is that it will be a mix of external and internal factors. Which will predominate, we'll see. The outline of the talk, I want to first of all put the whole idea of power flux in perspective, define power flux and why it is so important. The second theme of this presentation basically looks at how the strategic flux affects India's foreign policy. The third theme is regarding how the domestic debate is actually taking place in India as this strategic churning takes place in Asia Pacific. And lastly, this is 'cause kind of some kind of speculation. I was asked to do that to which way will India go and what will be those factors. So President Obama in his 2012 State of the Union address said that anyone who tells you that America is in decline or that our influence is waned doesn't really know what they're talking about. But two things which President Obama didn't elaborate upon were, first, what are they really talking about? Their shades of opinion on US decline, so to say. And second, why are they talking about it? What are the reasons for concern as US declines? Now, there are three schools of thought. The first believes that USA is in a relative decline, but it's not an absolute one. US will recuperate, but it will be a slow and painful process. Will definitely lose its preeminent position in the world. And Francis Fukuyama would say that it's the Z0 world, which is going to, which is going to take place in some sense. You will find similar arguments in the works of Robert Kaplan, Stephen Walt, and Farid Zakaria. As I was interviewing a lot of people before I came over here, in the words of one Indian ambassador, he basically defined US decline as US has caught a severe bout of pneumonia. You know, it will take time for US to recuperate. The second school of thought is basically one who basically kind of say that US is in an absolute decline and China is set to overtake US in next two decades. You can look at those arguments provided by people like Martin Jacques, who wrote a book called When China Rules the World, and a Washington DC based economist called Arvind Subramaniam in his own book Eclipse: Living in the Shadows of China's Economic Dominance. The third set of arguments is basically that no, this all is a lot more hype than there is real substance in it. And that US decline doesn't make sense because US has been declining since, you know, since 1945, so to say. There is a secular trend. So as US was the most predominant power then, and everybody else is rising so far. And you would find that argument in works of Robert Kagan, so to say. But a lot of Indians actually think that US is not in decline and it will actually recuperate, as I kind of interviewed a lot of people. And one thing they attribute is to, you know, the prospects of US gaining energy independence and the innovations which US economy has always kind of, you know, come up with. The second argument is basically that China will hit saturation in due time, but that its growth will also be much more constrained. You know, you can look at these arguments in works of John J. Mearsheimer or Edward Luttwak, which was basically the constraints of strategy, so to say, that others will gang up against China. But why should we talk about US decline? You know, what are those reasons for concern for us, so to say? The first is, power transitions are always dangerous periods, you know, and rise and fall of great powers is mostly accompanied by conflict, and you can see those arguments all over international relations in some sense. The problem I kind of find in this particular scenario is that there are two rising powers and a status quo power, and the two rising powers are actually neighbors. And it has never happened before. It's kind of, if I want to give a historical analogy, I would see Napoleonic France and Bismarckian Germany going together in early 20th century when British was actually declining. You know, the second is, perceptions of power do matter in international politics. And William Wolford's work on Soviet foreign policy elites, how they perceived US power at some point in time during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, gives an example of how, you know, perceptions of power really matter, not so much how power is actually distributed. And this is also because what David Baldwin calls the paradoxes of power. You know, you can locate power in resources, but you can also locate power in influence. And resources and influence doesn't really coincide always. And that is what is happening. If one can look at China's behavior post 2008, the assertiveness, the aggressiveness, somewhere down the line, one can correlate it with this whole idea that US is somewhere down the line going down. And also, in terms of US-India relations, you know, George W. Bush, how he thought about India as a rising power, is, and Condoleezza Rice coming in 2005 and saying that we'll make India a rising power, was to a certain extent believing this whole idea that US-India is a rising power. If you actually go and talk to Indians for that matter, and they will basically say that that US was not a Santa Claus giving us goodies. You know, we were already there and US realized it. So the perceptions of power matter really in terms of how foreign policy elites actually look at these things. The third is that U.S. will have to make some strategic readjustments, as it kind of declines. So to say, there is a material decline in what it can, what all it can do. Given U.S.'s pivotal role in international security architecture, such adjustments will have repercussions for regional players. Now, two examples, if I can kind of give it, put forward, is 2009 talks between when President Obama went to Beijing and asked China to kind of collaborate together to manage the world, the Great Power Condominium, as they say. But in 2012, they had a completely different strategy. It was basically to contain China, they rebalancing. Bharat Karnad, as he calls himself, the foremost conservative thinker in India, basically said to me that the very fact that the US, the global hegemon, has to prioritize the Pacific over the Atlantic is indicative of the pressure to adjust to its material decline. But is the issue simply of China's rise and US decline? Initially, when this whole idea of rise of other powers was basically put forward, the argument was that China's rise could be managed by USA's residual power and the strength of other rising powers. The Indo-US civil and nuclear deal was a case in point. But recent trends, however, suggest that the rise of the rest is actually not uniform. It's much more differentiated than was expected. As C. Rajamohan put it, the strategic imbalance between China on one hand, India and Russia on the other is growing fast, even as the power gap between Beijing and Washington narrows. In a sense that the other rising powers are actually not being able to catch up. And that one can see in the recent patterns of GDP growth in India and China, and also their defense budgets for that. There is a maximization of power as far as China and India are concerned. This actually leads to a very kind of an intriguing scenario where US decline in this context takes a completely different turn. There are doubts regarding US ability to kind of interfere and stabilize the situation. But there are also doubts regarding self, whether you can do it internally, so to say. And that makes this dynamic very explosive, so to say. As the second theme was basically that how strategic flux affects India's foreign policy. And it does it in a number of ways. First of all, I would come to the conceptual points. The structural conditions, the international context matters. And structural constraints not only guide your own foreign policy, but also of others who impinges upon you. The right reading of international context becomes extremely difficult when there's a strategic churning. I'll give you an example, 1962 war for that matter. Some of the revisionist historians in India are basically saying that India-China bilateral relationship, and just an example of foreign policy, is much more guided by international context than it is done by many of the idiosyncrasies of how different states follow their foreign policies, or idiosyncrasies of Mao or Nehru, so to say. When Mao took the decision to actually start the war, it was because there were certain indications from both Khrushchev and Kennedy that they would not come hard on China, so to say, and that was the context which allowed him to take that kind of decision. And therefore, international context matters. And Nehru, as Srinath Raghavan would say, in case of India-China relations at that point in time, became much more a realist than he actually was. And that was his misreading of the international context. So international context really matters. Second, that India is a swing state, and which way will it swing depends a lot on the strategic environment. But swing states have both flexibility as well as vulnerability, and that is the catch situation, so to say. How would India relate to changing balances of power is a crucial question. Would it be an American poodle, as is the case with Britain? Or would it be France, a strategically autonomous, the De Gaulle's whole idea of making France strategically autonomous, but still very much aligned in some sense with US? Or would it be China, a strategic adversary which has actually benefited from US hegemony? There is also a point with as China kind of grows and US declines and India stagnates, Would India be able to grow? There's a lot of paranoia. Whenever, if you look at 70s, 80s, and 90s, you'd see a lot of paranoia. That was particularly because India was not growing. So security concerns take a very different platform. When the state itself is not very confident of its ability to kind of answer the security concerns. Lastly, as one can see, in, you know, if you ever go back and read all these speeches given by foreign secretaries, the national security advisor, or the external affairs minister, the Indians keep on talking about the impending multipolarity, as if the multipolar world is just right there on the corner. But the prospects of Chinese unipolarity in Asia is a much more dreadful scenario for them. You know, India would like to have a multipolar world, but it definitely wants to avoid a unipolar Asia. In case of going out of those conceptual points in foreign policy, to look at bilateral relationships, so to say, and two important bilateral relations, and just a snapshot of what, you know, how it would affect India. In a sense that all US presidents till now, including Obama, have promised to maintain American primacy. Then, as John Mearsheimer would say, that are we going to look for a conflict between a growing power and a status quo declining power? In periods of power transitions, regional countries play an important role. And the whole idea of George Panetta basically coming to Delhi and saying, oh, India is the linchpin of rebalancing strategy, kind of elaborates upon that crucial role which regional countries, you know, get to play during times of power transitions. The second, for US audience particularly, and I keep on kind of listening to those policy debates in Washington DC, and one of the major policy debate is regarding the false promise of Indo-US nuclear deal. Basically, that we have invested so much of diplomatic capital in India, we aren't reaping anything out of it. So, you know, in terms of Indo-US relations, this strategic flux again makes, you know, an important dent in the relationship, so to say. There is, if you're following the academic debates, you would also see a lot of debate in US regarding which way will India go. So if you're going to read Zaghari and Friedman, and they would say that India is a natural ally, we are democracies, we have shared values, we have shared threats. Brzezinski and others would say that countries like India really doesn't matter in play great power games. Patch up with China, have a G2, and forget about everyone else. Whereas authors like Robert Kagan and Ashley Tallis would say that India really has no choice except to ally. And kind of tells you that the academic debate itself is very, very vigorous. And therefore, again, you know, how India responds to strategic flux becomes extremely important for us who are into this game of academic debates. I kind of characterize India-US relationship in these two periods. I kind of see from 1998 to 2008, you would see a strategic reconciliation between US and India. But since 2008, I would say that there is some kind of strategic reconsideration. There are a lot of questions being asked. To give you an example, between 1998 to 2008, India did many things that would have made Nehru or others, you know, kind of jump in their graves, so to say. You know, the first was India supported missile defense. If you go back to the strategic wars initiative of Ronald Reagan, you would see that one of the most trenchant critics was actually India. You know, on all the forums, India was actually saying no, no, and no. And it unconditionally supported missile defense. In fact, Jaswant Singh came to Washington, D.C., and he was told about Bush's 2001 strategic initiative much before it was announced to everyone else. It kind of said that we will provide unconditional support to the US in its war against terrorism. India was ready to give a base, military bases, and for its fight in Afghanistan. They had a better partner in Pakistan, so to say. In 2003, for the first time, India considered sending troops for foreign intervention, not under the rubric of the UN. There was a major debate in India, but the very fact that there was a debate and the Vajpayee government thought about it tells you a lot about how far India could went in that particular period. The next steps in strategic partnership between India and US was signed in 2005. In July 2005, we had Indo-US civilian nuclear deal, which culminated in 2008. India and US have conducted military exercises which outnumber the number of military exercises which US conducts with Japan, which US conducts with South Korea, and US conducts with NATO. Over $9 billion worth of defense imports have been there in the last 8 years. India helped achieve three major goals by doing this in this period of strategic reconciliation. First of all, it got itself dehyphenated from Pakistan. Nobody was looking at India in the same terms as Pakistan was doing. Second, it got parity with China. You know, this whole narrative of rising power, Indo-US civil and nuclear deal, provided us the same prestige and same recognition as was some say due to us, but it kind of put us in the same platform as China. But lastly, it also accepted India's nuclear weapon status. De facto, if not de jure. So all those three very important foreign policy objectives were realized. But after 2008, there have been a number of questions. Is India getting too close to the US? Is India's strategic partnership with US limiting its choices? What are the costs associated with getting aligned with the US? Is US a reliable partner? Will a declining US make strategic adjustments with China? And that is a very, very important question nowadays in India. Can US sustain its presence in the region? So all these questions kind of, you know, are impacting upon, and that is, in some sense, I could find a correlation between the decline and the coming up of these questions in Indian foreign policy circles. India-China relations, for that matter, have always been influenced by the US. If anybody who kind of thinks otherwise, just look at the record of it and you would see that the international context so much was shaped by US power, so to say, that there was a automatic implications for India-China relations. And if you could, in the Kennedy era, US and India came together. For the first time, there was this whole idea of democracies coming together. But after Nixon, till Bill Clinton, you know, there was this whole idea in India that there is an axis of US and China trying to contain India. And many basically say that this axis of powers between US, China and Pakistan was one of the reasons that India went nuclear, so to say, the inspiration for going nuclear. Bill Clinton went to Beijing just after India conducted its nuclear weapons test and asked China to kind of help stabilize South Asia. A prospect on which Indian foreign policy elites scoffed at. It was like, how can you actually ask China to come in? We are the major power in South Asia and nobody else should be allowed to interfere. But G.W. Bush actually saw a dramatic change in Indian-US relations. And after Obama, however, there are some kind of great power ambiguities. And this was particularly, as I talked to a lot of Indian decision makers, they were basically saying, oh, Obama in his first trip went to Beijing and asked China to have a great power condominium. What does that mean? You know, and then suddenly they have a rebalancing strategy. And therefore, there are ambiguities in terms of how the decline affected US recalibrating its policies. And that ambiguity has actually impinged upon how the Indian decision makers were thinking about what could US do and what it cannot do. But the strategic flux influences all core issues. Whether there's the border dispute with China, you know, the whole idea is that China may become more assertive as its power grows and India's ability to balance decreases, both in terms of internal balancing as well as external balancing. External balancing because US is declining. There are questions regarding US ability to kind of interfere. But also internal balancing because India is stagnating somewhere down the line, or the power maximization is actually very, very wide, you know, and it's growing. But also China-Pakistan strategic alignment, and one can see US's influence in Pakistan actually decreasing and China's influence actually increasing a lot, which is not a good news as far as Indian perspective. The frontiers in turmoil, this is a very important thing. If you look at India historically, India has always been very, very attentive to its frontiers, you know, especially in the West, whether it is the British history or the contemporary Indian history, so to say. And in the last 10 decades, actually, India rode on how US actually pacified Afghanistan, so to say. You know, Kashmir, in some sense, India reaped those security benefits in Kashmir. There is a problem as US kind of goes out of Afghanistan. There is a huge issue in India. And if somebody is looking at the policy debates right now, India is too concerned. As US leave Afghanistan, Iran gains a strategic heft. And that is happening. India may not be able to kind of make the similar kind of sacrifices on in Iran's policy as Iran becomes the pivot for India in Afghanistan. The nuclear competition might increase because if you are not able to balance internally, conventionally, so to say, and there is a problem with external balancing, the best strategy is to asymmetrically balance using nuclear weapons. That's what Pakistan does vis-a-vis India. There are regional complications, whether Asia will bandwagon or will Asia balance against China. And if And Paul Schrod and other historians would basically say that balancing is not the only strategy which states follow. They hide, they become neutral states, they bandwagon most of the times. And if the region bandwagons, one can see that debate happening in Australia a lot. Institutional ambitions. India has certain institutional ambitions, whether it is UN Security Council or it is MTCR or it is NSG. And US influence has actually helped India to realize some of those goals. Indo-US civilian nuclear deal was an example. But as you but as US declines, its influence decreases. One can see that debate happening in NSG right now, you know, giving about the membership in India. And there are indications that China will make India's entry into global institutions more problematic. Lastly, whether there is a great power competition or there is a great power condominium, it is a headache for India. US and China may reach an accommodation at India's expense, or US will draw India into an unnecessary or unwarranted conflict with China. So there are these concerns which kind of influence Indian foreign policy a lot. And this is happening because of three reasons. First, of this unprecedented rise in China's growth. Many people basically say, you know, many Indians say that it is manageable, but there is a growing anxiety within India. The second is the differentiated growth among rising powers. You know, the rest of the rise of the rest is not uniform, which I kind of indicated earlier. But also US's relative decline and the consequent ambiguity. These are the three main reasons why strategic flux is kind of creating those debates. Now I come back to the third theme of my presentation, which is basically on to reflect on how this particular issue is being debated in India's foreign policy circles. And this is something which is directly coming from the Rising Powers Initiative and the work done by Dr. Ola Bali and Professor Rajesh Rajagopalan, who happens to be my supervisor for my PhD dissertation. And I put this in an order that so who are these people actually? You know, what are we talking about? Traditional nationalists are those who are embedded in the discourse of India's freedom movement. Now, traditional nationalists can be defined as those thinkers of foreign policy who emphasize on strategic autonomy in matters concerning foreign policy, recommend eschewing power politics, believe in the intrinsic importance of India as the basis of its claim to a great power status, and support the idea of an equitable global order based on democratic decision making. The great power realists, on the other hand, are those thinkers who want India to become a great power and are not shy of bandwagoning with other great powers, especially US, to achieve the desired ends. For them, China is a clear long-term threat, but rather than engaging China on its own, they recommend forging strategic alliances with other like-minded nations like US. For them, if India wants to be a great power, it cannot escape the logic of power politics. Objective national interests rather than anachronistic ideals for them should be the benchmark for foreign policy. Liberals, on the other hand, are those who advocate economic development as the road to national security. Thinkers under this paradigm mostly focus on economics as the driver of India's great power status. For India to be a great power, it has to be an economic power first. On the other hand, leftists are those who are Marxist in orientation, are mainly focused on creating an anti-hegemonic alliance vis-a-vis the US. They share a number of traits with traditional nationalists. Insofar, they advocate absolute freedom from hegemonic interference in foreign policy decision-making, trenchantly oppose any form of loose alliances with the US and its partners, and argue for sweeping changes to be made in instruments of global governance. The hyper-realists are those who want India to behave like a great power, but solely on its own. Use of force more often in order to realize national objectives, and want an all-direction nuclear deterrent. International system, according to them, is highly anarchic and logic of self-help rules. It is foolish to bandwagon with other great powers, and especially the US. And they believe that regarding China and Pakistan, that India must rely on superior military capabilities and force them to submission from a position of military dominance. And lastly, the Nehruvians, who believe that international anarchy can be mitigated by the rule of law and normative behavior. As far as they relate regarding the relationship with China is concerned, they basically say that these two are civilizational powers and have never been hostile to each other in their history. In case of both Pakistan and China, India should eschew all strategies dead border provocation. With regard to great powers, Nehruvians talk about non-alignment. Now, this is something which I came up with when I was basically looking at these domestic debates. If you look at the row, this is of the opinion, basically describe the opinion of whether people think China is rising and US is declining. The first section of the row basically are those opinion makers who think that China is rising but US is declining. The second is basically those who think China is rising but they question the idea of US decline. On the other hand, you look at the column, basically kind of suggests whether this particular opinion is seen in terms of a strategic concern or seen in terms of a strategic opportunity. Strategic concern, whether it will complicate India's foreign policy negatively a lot, I'll explain why, or whether it is a positive development insofar it provides a strategic opportunity, and I explain how it becomes a strategic opportunity. And this is how I place them, in a sense. The Nehruvians and traditional nationalists are those who basically think that China is rising and US is declining and see this particular phenomena as a strategic concern. Great power realists kind of agree that China is rising and US is declining, but see this phenomena as a strategic opportunity. Hyper realists, this is not a foolproof map, let me just say, you know, as Kenneth Waltz would say it, you know, it's kind of, it's far removed from reality. It's not a description, it's much more of a conceptual map. You know, some of the hyper-realists would actually say that China is rising and US is declining, but it's also hard to map these opinions, as you would have yourself kind of, you know, experienced, that people say very different things in very different points in time. That was the idea of actually going and interviewing these people, some of them. And the whole exercise helps us in some sense to get hold of, you know, at a broad level of different kind of trajectories which are taking place. And lastly, I used a different category, which are basically bandwagoners. I'll describe why I kind of find anyone else being put there a little bit more more difficult than using that word on bandwagoners. So here it is, what policy they prescribe. So if you are a Nehruvian and you are part of the first box, which thinks that China is rising and US is declining, and you see that as a strategic opportunity, you would basically prescribe a policy of strategic autonomy. And what does that mean? It basically means that conflict with China is not inevitable. Follow the policy of non-alignment and vouch for multipolarity. They basically look at the flexibility part of the swing state much more than they look at the vulnerability part. And we'll come to that later. They're skeptical of US commitment to the Asia Pacific. They think that it is too costly and US will not be able to sustain it. They want India to maintain good relations with China by the instruments of trade and diplomacy, but they also suggest internally balancing China. Follow independent policy with respect to Pakistan and Afghanistan. US is too weak to help. It's kind of, its influence in these regions is declining. And they also suggest that Indian Ocean is a zone of peace. It is not a zone of conflict, and great powers can be accommodated. Great power realists basically talk of strategic engagement. I would say engagement san alliances. Alliances is something which, you know, doesn't have a lot of heft in Indian foreign policy, especially because of the domestic considerations and also on the historical lineages of Indian foreign policy thought. And they basically, they think that China, the conflict with China is likely. For the first time, India has a chance to ensconce itself in the geopolitical map of Asia, and that is partially because the US wants India to have a greater role. You know, like Clinton coming to India and saying, oh, don't only look east but act east, so to say, and Indian Ocean and all other places where US wants India to actively engage. And they want to actively balance China with the help of the US. They prescribe external balancing. They ask for military pacts to be with the US to be consummated. They seek equal partnership with US on pacifying Afghanistan and handling Pakistan. They think that US needs us. And to manage Indian Ocean along with the US. But they also prescribe building partnerships with like-minded states, which are Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, and Australia. In some sense, they also want some kind of regional balancing to take place, not put your all eggs into one basket, so to say. If you are in that box where you think that China is rising, but you really don't believe in US decline, and think it is, again, as a strategic concern, you would prescribe the policy of strategic independence. And hyper-realists have been prescribing the policy of independence whether there is a strategic flux or not, always. Bharat Karnad is one example of that. They think that China, the conflict with China is inevitable. They kind of prescribe India to build its national power based on military and especially nuclear capability. The whole nuclear equation comes prominently in their prescriptions. And China can only be balanced internally by maximizing the nuclear deterrent. You can't outsource your security to the Americans, follow independent policies in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Indian Ocean is a sphere of influence, don't let it go. And US is too overstressed to help. Regional balancing might be a better option, but don't at all look towards US helping you out. Bandwagoners, on the other hand, are those who are, in some sense, talk about an alignment, a proper alignment with the US, in some sense, actually going for strategic alliances. They think that conflict with China is inevitable. However, they think that this is of decline is false, as has been a number of times. Continue the path of strategic bandwagoning with the US, as was the case during the Bush era. China too strong to be handled alone. Regional balancing will not work because other states are too small and too weak. Great power status can only come from engagement with the US. And they refer to the memberships of the NSG, the MTCR, the UNSC. And they also say that India is actually not being able to catch up with China. And you must always remember that people who basically talk about internal balancing are not very appreciative of this fact that India is not being able to catch up with China. The real debate actually is between those, and the later two, the bandwagoners and the hyper-realists, are actually on the margins, so to say. You know, I think the real debate is between those who think that the current strategic flux India should go for strategic autonomy, and those who think that it is basically a geopolitical opportunity which India should actually grab with both hands. And the non-alignment part is the arrow is bigger, because I think that the current context actually the policy is actually towards non-alignment much more than alignment 2.0. And I call it alignment 2.0 because India has a history of some kind of alignment. If one looks back at India-Soviet friendship, Treaty of Friendship in 1971, and India's consequent behavior in UN General Assembly over Afghanistan and many other issues would give you an idea that India was somewhere down the line also constrained by this particular partnership, which Indians don't like to reuse the word alliances, so to say. So what do non-alignment 2.0 means? They think that conflict is not inevitable, but they focus much more on the flexibility part of it, that India can actually shuffle around. You know, India is a swing state, and it can use its being the swing state much more. And for that, there should be a balance between US and China. If they move in either of the extremities, so to say, either if they get together or they kind of get into a conflict, then India would have to choose, and they want to avoid choices. That's how they would really like to maintain that idea of flexibility. They think that there are a number of areas of cooperation between India and China, but they also think that India should internally balance, and they think that US is not a reliable partner. You know, and they don't like the idea of alliances because they think that idea of alliances make you to specialize in things. And India doesn't want to specialize, as was the case with NATO and Japan and others, where you specialize in a particular area of defense or a particular area, you know, and kind of there is a division of labor, and they would really won't like to do that division of labor. They also think that US would not even come to aid when there is a fundamental clash of interest. Would US allow India to go after Pakistan? You know, if there is a serious concern. So as I was talking to Srinath Raghavan, who was basically one of those who wrote this whole paper on non-alignment 2.0, he was basically of the opinion that US has not been a very reliable ally. And so are the hyper-realists. Bharat Kanant, for that matter, basically pointed out to me the whole history of US being not a very reliable ally, so to say. The motto, therefore, for them is to engage with all great powers, and what they called engagement sans entanglement. Don't get entangled into alliances. The alignment 2.0, on the other hand, basically is that conflict is actually very, very likely, and they focus on India's vulnerability much more than they focus on India's flexibility. They think that if you can manage with China by trade, well, do that, but it's really under question, so to say. Balancing externally because there is no other option. You know, the costs of not engaging are much more than costs of engaging, so to say. China is a threat and US is the most likely ally. And they also think that engaging with others is fine, but will reap less dividends than engaging with US. So engagement with US is much more important than anything else. Now, why do I think that non-alignment, yeah, this might be a second, the policy implications. So if you are on the non-alignment 2.0 part, you would say that basically don't be too enthusiastic about the pivot. Questions regarding its sustainability and potential costs are much more. Engage with all great powers simultaneously. Don't exclude the China from management of Indian Ocean. Enter into a cooperative security architecture with them and other powers, including US. Follow independent policy in Afghanistan, including a regional security approach with China and Pakistan. And foster an independent policy in Iran. On the other hand, if you are on the other side of it, pivot is a strategic opportunity. Engage all great powers, and clearly the particular Indian Ocean part is coming from Raja Mohan's book, basically looking at China's involvement in the Indian Ocean as very devilish, if I can kind of translate that particular Indian word. And Indians and Americans are the angels of Indian Ocean. And US's absence from Afghanistan would be debilitating to Indian interests. And Pakistan and China are basically going to exclude India from future management of. Why do I think non-alignment is coming back? I think one of the reasons, and I particularly feel this, is that this whole idea of return of Indian exceptionalism, so to say, you know, with India's growth, this whole idea that India is too important for the world to be given that particular status is actually gaining momentum. And you could actually look at all the speeches of foreign secretaries and external affairs minister, and you'd see, oh, India must grow in its own right, and US should recognize it. You should recognize that India's growth in itself would be a positive factor, which I am a little skeptical of, though. The second is the historical disposition of the Congress party. And I think this whole idea somehow had some kind of the whole non-alignment 2.0. You know, many critics basically said that that there was Sunil Khilnani was basically doing it for Rahul Gandhi, so to say, to give him a foreign policy perspective. So there is disposition towards that historical lineages of Nehru much more in the Congress party than is in other domestic political parties. But more so, I think, because of the US decline in its ambiguities. And I'll give you an example for that. Just after Obama went to Beijing, you know, a high level delegation from US came to India. And they're basically saying, so Indians were like, oh, you were talking about a great power condominium in Beijing, and we thought that you are playing the balance of power game. That's what we thought since 1998, and that's why we were part of the game. And the high level in US delegation, somebody in that delegation basically thought, oh, we are done with balances of power game, you know. So there was a lot of confusion within India that what is actually US doing. And I think those consequent ambiguities have actually led the idea of non-alignment to have some traction. What will influence the debate? I think, first of all, the external factors will influence the debate much more than the internal factors. The China's rise and its consequent behavior. Right now, there is a tussle going on the border between India and China. And the Indians are basically saying that the PLA has made an incursion and they have set up a tent 10 kilometers inside the Indian territory, whereas MEA is hopeful that that it will be sorted out peacefully. Let's see how it will be sorted out. But there is really a growing concern in India regarding, Times of India actually reported that there are 600 incursions since 2010. Times of India is again a very bombastic nationalist newspaper, according to my opinion. But so is the case. And then if India finds itself in a corner, then it might again go for some kind of external balancing. And 1971 is a case in point. Many people kind of forget that structural constraints actually made India to do something like that. Success and failure of US's rebalancing strategy, but more so its recovery from financial downslide, because a lot of Indian economy also depends upon US economy, so to say. But also most importantly, India's own internal consolidation. You know, whether we are able to kind of push those economic reforms, so to say. Now, since 1991, once they did that, Narasimha Manmohan Singh government, I think everybody's of the opinion, even Sanjay Baru would say that, who is a major geo-economist in some sense, that India has not been able to push those reforms. And India's economy is also stagnating. We are talking about The rising power narrative in India was coming in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009. We are basically thinking that we will grow at 6 to 8%. Last quarter, we are growing at 4.5%, and it's not going to be better in some sense. And as far as I am, as a student of Indian foreign policy and Indian domestic politics, understand that the internal concerns drive, you know, the security paranoia, in paranoia to a certain extent. And lastly, this is just an afterthought, but I just wanted to put it in a sense, you know, that the whole rage regarding Modi's coming, my own dissertation is somewhere down the line reflecting upon how different political ideologies make a difference. But I think it will be a leadership factor much more than it will be an ideological factor. I don't see major political parties doing very differently in terms of political ideologies, but more the factor in terms of leadership styles might be a very different factor. Thank you.
Okay. Yogesh, thank you for that very comprehensive and informative presentation. If I may start by making a couple of points and then asking a question. When you suggested at the end about internal factors being extremely important, I mean, I was waiting for you to bring that in, in part because when you look at the strategic flux over time, and there has been, not just this time, but earlier, India has weathered a number of different strategic fluxes. And yet, one thing that you see at the balance between the non-alignment 2.0, as you call it, and alignment 2.0, that non-alignment band has been much wider, and it's been consistent. So if there has been the strategic flux, then you have to account for why there is that continuity. And for that continuity, you need to bring it, the internal factors in some sense, earlier. But then the question is, what has to change internally in order to make that full shift from the non-alignment, not just to alignment, but to the other three corners of the in the box? It could be great power realists, it could be, you left out globalists altogether, and I think that you need to understand. I think if you bring that into constraints that India is going to face in terms of really shifting, because the globalists, and that brings me to the third point, that is the possible alliances among the different groups. So the traditional nationalists and the globalists may or may not agree, but the great power realists and the globalists would form a coalition.
Yeah.
Now, if they manage to sort of push out the hyper realists, which is a minority, and the bandwagoners, which is a small minority, then you're really left with three of these other groups, the nationalists, the globalists, and the great power realists. And that's where the debates will take place in some sense. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say. But so my question to you then is, what has to happen internally, do you think, in order for, forget the rise of China, but what has to happen internally in order for these schools of thought to completely shift one way or the other, the center of gravity to change? What do you think?
I'll just start with, I'll answer the question.
Okay.
I have an answer for it, and that's a very intuitive answer, so to say. And I'll start with that. When you're basically looking at these opinions, you know, I think there is a generational and in terms of what kind of experiences, especially if we're talking about foreign policy, have. You know, if you actually go back, all these ambassadors who are talking about it, who are basically formulating these policies, have a particular generational experience. You know, and that experience actually counts a lot, you know, before Cold War. That generational shift hasn't actually taken place. We have very few strategic thinkers like C. Rajamohan and others who are making a dent, but haven't still been able to do that. And same is the case with people who are actually managing policies. You know, all the people who, in a democracy, if I remember the famous, the second book of Kenneth Waltz, you know, it's kind of makes a comparative analysis of British politics and US politics. The leadership which comes to which kind of makes these decisions comes through a very different kind of social churning. The socialization process itself makes them, you know, inclined towards certain ideas. And that is basically, I think, one of the reasons, that's my own intuitive feeling, so to say, is that that generational shift which has to take place. If internally, if you're talking about that, I don't know how much of that is convincing, but I personally feel that the socialization process of leadership, even in terms of, and India's bureaucratic services are so, that these residual elements actually influence a lot more than your new thinking. I'm saying that because in some sense I'm conceptualizing that thinking. You know, I'm really not conceptualizing real policy making, but those impulses. And therefore, I think a sociological understanding of it would be much more, you know, convincing than making any other. Globalists, yeah, I was kind of confused where to put them. You know, if you can put them also in terms of the Nehruvians. You know, I was kind of talking about trade and other things, peaceful mitigation in some sense, peaceful resolution of conflicts using neoliberal ideas, so to say. Yeah, the debate actually resides between these three. I think the traditional nationalists, Nehruvians, I'll group them together, and globalists and great power realists. They do agree a number of times, but they also don't agree a number of times. See Rajamohan for that matter. It's very, very hard to conceptualize him. He's a liberal globalist today, he's a great power realist tomorrow. You know, so you really...
He's a great power realist. But anyway,
yeah. So it's really hard. Right. So I was kind of confused whether to actually bring in globalists. Also because I was talking something about very, very much related to security, not so much about, you know, about the soft stuff, if I can use that word.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Of course, the China-India factor. You need to bring in the economics in some sense as well. That would be useful. But let me leave that and turn it. To the audience, questions, comments. Tim?
I would like to see if you could take in another one of these major debates, India's potential interest in UN Security Council reform, and joining that particular group as a permanent member of Security Council. How much interest and how big of a priority is that for India? And then within that, if it is a high priority, where does the various schools of thought come into that debate, and especially what they feel like they need to do to be able to get a part of that group? What kind of consolidations do we need to make to China to get their permission to join the group, or as well as alliances that are made with Russia and the United States to be able to get their support as a part of that? And how does that fit into the strategy?
Right. The opinion would be like unanimous that India really needs to get a permanent seat in the United States. In the UNSC.
Within all of those schools?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think so. Everyone, it's a foreign policy priority for India to get into UN Security Council.
Well, I think the hyper-realists or hyper-nationalists wouldn't really care because
they don't believe
in international organizations.
They won't really
they don't believe
care so much.
It doesn't seem that
but if it is something which is given as a condition, everybody would like to be there. You know, in some sense, but the strategies would be very, very different. You know, thinkers who will fall in Nehru categories of Nehruvians and non-traditional nationalists would basically say that India will get it in due time. You know, given the kind of resources it has, given its attributes. You know, you really can't exclude India for so long. But the strategy would be to engage with UN General Assembly in multilateral forums. And also multipolarity in some sense, you know, the coming of the as soon as multipolarity is there, you might get a shot at UN Security Council. Whereas great power realists and globalists, great power realists particularly, I'm really confused about globalists, where to put them. But great power realists particularly would basically say that you would get that position much easily and quickly if you engage with great powers more, you know, particularly US and others. And they will be skeptical regarding China. They would be really skeptical about China, and they would say that and you know, somebody like Mohan Malik basically was kind of basically argues that there is this institutional shadow boxing between India and China. That back in 2005, when the high level delegation in the UN was actually talking about Chinese security reforms, the problem for China is that the group of four, as they call Germany, Brazil, Japan, and India, and China, some Chinese delegate came to India and basically said that we can support your candidature, but will not support Japan's. And the group of four is basically saying that no, if we need to get it, we'll get it together. China is much more inclined to support Brazil and Germany, also because of the trade thing and others, but not so much in case of India and China, particularly because of Pakistan. Pakistan doesn't really want India to be there, especially with the veto. You know, and there is a conflict between India and China, so to say. You know, so it kind of makes the dynamics in its own interest. It's not that Chinese are, you know, kind of there is any evil or something. Every other state would, India would never like Pakistan to join UN Security Council, though it also has claims.
Yes.
I actually have two questions.
Okay.
First question is,
could you just identify yourself?
Yeah, my name is Vinod. I'm an exchange student from Singapore. The first question is, how much, you know, when you talk about strengthening Indian foreign policy, how much do you think it would be down to domestic institutions? And by that I mean both in terms of the Ministry of External Affairs and the Indian Foreign Policy. Because there's a lot you read about how it's sort of lacking manpower and stuff like that, and very small foreign service. For the size that
smaller India. Than Singapore.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's comparable
which is
to Singapore's foreign service.
No, it's smaller. The number of foreign service
is
officers
smaller?
Is smaller than Singapore's foreign service.
Okay, well, this makes it all the more pressing, I guess.
India's.
And also, well, in terms of, you know, you spoke about how there's a growing divergence between China and India as far as military expenditure is concerned. And I think the sense that at least some of us get from Southeast Asia is that there's a much closer relationship in China between the government and the military and the Navy than is the case in India. So that would be the first question. My second question is, you know, when you talk about all these great power politics and strategy and everything, so where in these debates, how would you say Pakistan is positioned today in terms of how the Indian foreign policy is constructed?
Okay. Yeah, I'll just come to the first question. It's an interesting question, and you'd see some of the people actually raising it. Shashi Tharoor in his latest book, for example. And the strength of the Indian diplomatic personnel is something like 700 people at all, and for all the embassies, for all the institutions around the world. And that too, who caters to, you know, MEA in the South Bloc also. So that is a real problem. But I think you must understand it in terms of, you know, it's again very intuitive. It's about the policy elites having that power, you know, and not expending it. I'll give you an example. Every other country in the world can, the citizens from every other country in the world can sit for UN civil service. Indians cannot. They directly cannot, and that is particularly because the foreign service isn't allowed it. You know, the foreign service really doesn't want it. And in all forums, in all institutions, if you ever been to any institution, you would see that Indian diplomats actually dominating those institutions in terms of their numbers. And they practically think that if actually it expands, their shared interests would be compromised. So it's much more about those bureaucratic, you know, what do you call the bureaucratic politics. And bureaucracies, as Max Weber would say, you know, the first objective of a bureaucracy is to maintain itself. You know, that's what bureaucracies are made for. And you would see that in any other bureaucracy. You know, the Indian Foreign Service institutions just next across JNU, for that matter. It's a very small place for a foreign service institute to be, you know, in India. it's like School of International Studies. That's it. The campus is that much. So I think there is, yeah, regarding the military not being in sync, that the military keeps on complaining about it. You know, the latest book to look at it, basically Admiral Koithara's book, Managing India's Nuclear Forces. And he's basically complaining this, that you really don't have an operational deterrent because you haven't actually involved the military. You know, I'm just telling you, military at at the level of the nuclear, you know, at the level of nuclear deterrence, so to say. And he thinks that nuclear deterrence is being compromised because military is not in the loop. But at every other stage, military is not in the loop, and that's what people are complaining about. But there are others who basically say that that's the model India has followed and that has worked well for India. You know, the model of Indian civil military relations has worked much better if you compare it with all other South Asian neighbors, so to say. And therefore the primacy of politics, in some sense, our politicians, you know, if I can say that, remains there. I don't think that's changing a lot, so to say. But there may be some dents which the military might make in the future. There's a whole debate regarding chief of defense staff. You know, something like that, a joint chief of staff. Something like that is taking place since 1995. But we haven't been able to do that. And the simple idea is that if there is a war tomorrow, and you saw that in Kargil war, basically. The VP Malik was basically entreating Tipnis, who was the air chief marshal, to send in the Air Force. And it's like, no, until and unless the Prime Minister intervened. So there is a lack of that coordination. And that will happen tomorrow, that may happen tomorrow as well. So there's a real concern regarding it. But I think the opinion is basically slated in the favor of just maintaining those civil-military relations, because it has worked for India's political structure rather than military efficiency.
But don't you think that if we wanted to project our Indian mission, that is under extending the districts in Africa, then don't you think it would call for closer formation between
Look, I'll give you an example of nuclear submarines.
Yeah.
You know, once you have nuclear weapons loaded down there, you know, the current Indian strategy is basically that the warheads are with the DAE, the trigger mechanisms are with DRDO, and the launching vehicles are with the Army. And whenever there is an emergency, these three have to collaborate together at a strategic location and then jumble these parts together and fire it. Now, so thing of a nuclear submarine, once you have nuclear weapons there, you have to delegate some authority to the military. Personally, I feel that technological advancements, ballistic missile defense for that matter, how would it work? You know, so those technological advancements which you will make would dent that idea of civil military relations somewhere down the line. Second question was of Pakistan. I think it remains a high priority, but the strategy to tackle with Pakistan keeps on, you know, rotating it. I don't know. Sometimes the recent example in the whole hoopla regarding trade. I'm a skeptic towards trade and other things for that matter, even regarding with China, so to say. You know, $100 billion of trade where your participation is only $20 billion. You know, so doesn't really make sense. Even look at China-Japan relations for that matter. You have $400 billion of trade, but doesn't really seem that it has specified India-Japan-China relations. You know, so trade, when it comes to that, I'm a little skeptic. I think there are serious issues with that. And Afghanistan unravels, those strategic divergences would crop up much more than what is seen today. Pakistan is still ruminating over an MFN status for last 1.5 years, you know, to India. But I don't know how it works out, but it remains a priority at least for the establishment. You know, and they want to have all kinds of strategies to tackle. Which one? I don't know whether they would ever have any meaningful strategy to tackle.
Okay, maybe just a last quick question, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Deputy Grove for the AR magazine. I want to ask a question about the perception that due to U.S. policy in the Middle East and the dissolution, basically, of the Sykes-Picot arrangements, which is basically what's going on now. How does that affect India's role in the region? I was thinking about the region.
Can you just elaborate on the U.S. strategy in the Middle East? I couldn't get that.
Oh, not really. Sykes-Picot, it was a French-British operation, but it was always guaranteed, the borders were always guaranteed by Americans and so on. And now, this is all up in the air. We've been participating in going after the strongest nations and so on. So, that's perception people have in the region, at least, that's what's happening.
Right. I'll just kind of elaborate upon that. In US Middle East policy, especially in the last 1 year or so, if you look at, I'll just take two or three cases, Iran particularly, you know, Syria, and Libya, so to say, if these three, if I can kind of relate them to Indian policy. There used to be a diplomat in India who basically said that the democracy is like a caste system. You are either born in it or you're out of it. You know, so it's like, so Indians really don't think that. That's what he kind of explained. It was that you really can't change much of it. So people are either born with democracy or they are not, and you can't export democracy to others. And that's what you would see in India's approach to it. You know, especially with Libya, India was against it. Syria, they finally came into, you know, came into the fold, but after much reluctance. Sri Lanka is a different case because it's much more internally motivated by the India's consideration of human rights violations in Sri Lanka. You know, the Indian government was mum at the time the Sri Lankan Sinhalese were going after the Tamils there. Iran is a difficult case. Again, there is this whole a fundamental principle that political ideologies should be chosen by the native people. You know, you really can't like a particular ideology and you can't really dislike it. India would like everyone to be a democratic state and liberal state, but that cannot be exported. And that is the case with Iran. As far as Iran's nuclear weapons is concerned, India has categorically said time and again that India is against nuclear weapons from Iran, so to say. But I don't know how much India would be helpful in terms of changing the dispositions of these regimes around. I think that would be a non-starter as far as India is concerned.
Okay, I think we've come to the end of the session, but I think we'll all agree that Yogesh is off to a great start as a budding academic and also a good professor. So please join me in thanking him and also wishing him good luck with the rest of his education. And there's quite a lot of food over there, so grab some before you leave. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think